Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
absolutely,
if we're uncomfortable talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
This is What's Next on WBFO. I am your host, Jillian Hainsworth, and I'm very excited by our guest today. Joining us, we have Alex Burgos, who is a 2024 delegate for the DNC and, if I might add, the only Hispanic delegate for 2024. We also have Talia Rodriguez. She is a mom, a community advocate, and a recent candidate for the Buffalo Public School School Board representing the West District. How are you guys doing?
Good. How about yourself?
I'm good.
Super excited to be here.
So I'm excited about our conversation. For our listeners, we're going to be talking a lot about the Hispanic vote. So let's just jump in. How do you feel when it comes to being classified as one voter block in general?
I think the Hispanic community and our voter base has grown incredibly unique over the years as engagement has changed locally, statewide, and nationally. But I think many people would argue that we are not a voter block at this point. We represent a diverse segment of voters that, we even talked about this on the phone. There was data from Univision from this past cycle that indicated that Hispanic voters, up to 60% of them, don't necessarily have any loyalty to either party, and that they could be swayed by any platform or candidate that appealed to the issues that they cared about. And so Hispanic voters don't necessarily function as a block anymore. They function as a segment of people that are voting based on the issues that directly impact their lived experience.
Yes, so that was very succinct, Alex. I'm so proud of him. That was a fantastic answer. And as he alluded, we've had a lot of conversations, Jill, about how our community voted or will continue to vote. And one of the privileges that I had was writing a column on it. And I told, in one of the intro sentences, I told people, we are no longer a voting block, but like mini voting roadblocks. Because I think that when I was doing research and in conversation with Alex and other community leaders, the economy was the number one issue that was resonating with the Latino voters that were polled, right? Even throughout the United States. And then secondarily, you see a lot of change of opinion around issues that impact different identities, like how Hispanic males are voting versus Hispanic females, mm-hmm. and even within age range also.
And where can this column be found?
Okay, Jill, thank you. Jill's like, don't come here, waste my time. Absolutely. So my column is in the local Latino newspapers here. It's also on Swell, which I would love to talk to you more about. It's a micro podcast platform and on my website. But yeah, I would love to talk with you more about just what that process was like, because it was a lot of eclectic research.
Yeah, so you said that like a lot of people are not necessarily beholden to one political party or mm-hmm. another, which I love to hear, because I feel like sometimes we find ourselves in really sticky situations when we just vote along party lines, regardless of what the party is saying they're going to do, what they have historically showed us they were willing or able to do. Mm-hmm. So aside from parties, like we're not going to talk about being a Democrat right now, but we are in... We're supposed to be in a democracy, right? Our country, it's a democracy. It's designed that way, and right. we're hoping that we can keep it that way.
Right.
But paint a picture for me of what an ideal democracy looks like.
That's such a good question. Alex, you want to go first?
I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind, I feel like the golden era was Obama, at least in my lifetime.
Yes. And for me, I love that answer because shout out to him. And I had the privilege of being in D.C. serving as an intern in federal government at that time. And there was a lot of beautiful energy in D.C. But for me, a healthy democracy involves voices of many ages. Specifically, a healthy democracy, in my view, Jill, centers the voices of our youth. Like, that's the democracy that I think we need to have. And then also, because I know you know me, I'm going to add delicious food. Because in democracy is hard work. We need to feed people, right? Mm-hmm. So having the eclectic conversation and the diverse conversation be reflective in the culture that we're living to mm-hmm. while we're taking breaks from that hard work.
Nice.
I also think, too, education is really, like, the biggest thing. You know, if you're looking in the Hispanic community, oftentimes our children are going to the most disinvested schools. And that sets the tone, not just in our community, but overall where our democracy is headed. If people don't have any recollection of the process by which we got to where we're at now, to have the rights that we are afforded today, to the democracy, to the, you know, civic unrest and protests that afforded people like us more rights, then we'll never understand what being engaged in a truly democratic process means. So that's why when people say they want to strip DEI or they want to defund the Department of Education or leave it to the states or this and that, that becomes very dangerous.
Yeah.
Right? And particularly book bans, mm-hmm. which are disproportionately impacting both segments of my identity, mm-hmm. you know, being a person of color, Latino, and being a member of the LGBT community, we're seeing how not only misinformation, but the removal of information altogether can become very dangerous and insidious.
Yeah, I mean, historically, the good guys have never been the ones to ban the books, right? It's always been the bad guys.
Yeah, they don't usually make the books, I feel like, Jill.
Exactly.
So, yeah, they're not the ones.
So,
yeah, I think I feel similarly. We were talking about the research showing that healthy democracy is held up by healthy local news. Mm-hmm. Having news that's generated at the city level by diverse voices statistically impacts the democratic environment and the health of democracy in that city. And there's been people who have overlaid the amount of different newspapers with what voting trends look like. And, you know, having those spaces and spaces like you're making for people to come to be involved in politics in ways that they feel affirming that are circulating in their community, I think is really powerful. Yeah. So. Mm-hmm.
Alex, you said the Obama era to you was like the golden era. What about that era like sticks out to you? Because for me, like one of my favorite eras, and I know this might be somewhat of a controversial take, but like whatever, the era of like the Black Panther Party when it comes to education, when it comes to feeding each other, like the fact
you knew that I was gonna go there.
They were able to have kids come in the morning before school and you ate.
Yeah.
And then after school you came and your education was supplemented with further education with Black history, and then they fed them again, and like they really gave the people an opportunity to create with their community mm-hmm. and in turn society, their direct society looks like for them, for themselves. And when I think about the Obama era, obviously you think about the energy, mm-hmm. like people wanted to vote, people wanted to turn out.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the day, so my birthday is November 5th, so it's always on or around Election Day.
Yeah.
And Election Day was November 4th that year for his first term. It was November 4th. And then on the 5th, it was like 1 a.m., 2 a.m. when they finally said, like, Barack Obama is going to be the next president.
That's like a
birthday
gift.
And me and my sisters and my cousins, everybody was at my mom's house. My mom was in the bed, and we all started like screaming and cheering. My mom thought something was wrong, so she like runs down the stairs with her bonnet on and her purse, like, what's wrong? Like, thinking, you know, we're about to need to get up out of there. But just the excitement around that moment was really encouraging. Now it seems like when it's time to vote, people are like, ugh. Okay, here we go.
Yeah.
Let's just see what happens. So, like, is that what you think about when you think about that era?
Well, I mean, that was the era that I experienced in my lifetime. You know, I'm still relatively young. I'm only 26.
Yeah,
so
I was going to say how old are you then, Alex?
I haven't lived through very many presidencies. I've lived through you know, some heavy presidencies.
Enough, right? Yeah. You lived through enough.
But not very many. Mm-hmm. When I think of Obama, I think of, you know, the primary between him and Hillary Clinton, two both very popular candidates, both very beloved, you know, in the communities that I'm part of. And I remember that energy that I saw on that debate stage. That is what got me as a little boy into politics. Mm-hmm. I remember I would be at my uncle's house on West Ferry talking to everyone about the election and what I saw in the debate and this and that. And it was just really exciting. And so for me, that was the moment that sort of captured me and scooped me in and, you know, retained my political interest, retained my engagement interest. Mm-hmm. And to know further on that Obama, you know, as my career progressed, Obama was a community organizer, mm-hmm. just like I was, you know, and then he went on to, you know, run for various levels of government and then eventually become president. And so seeing Obama start off as a community organizer, somebody who grew up in a similar upbringing as myself, be able to ascend to that height sort of made me feel like this is something that everyday people can do.
Yeah, it made and it achievable.
I think President Obama really represented the American dream, not only in the way that he got there, but also being someone that many people had been made to feel were less American. And so he defied that narrative. Mm-hmm. He engaged in the process, he won, and he set a tone for a lot of people that came after him. And I mean, democracy has its ups and downs. You know, different civilizations are always going to have their uprests. They're always going to have their times of turbulence. This is another, you know, time of turbulence that we're about to enter in that we now have to resolve. And it won't be the last. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's sometimes very scary for a lot of people to hear that it won't be the last. But that's why, you know, it's important for us, you know, as people that are like-minded, for one, to pace ourselves, two, make sure we're getting our rest, but then three, continue to find a reason to be engaged in this fight and in this movement so we can retain the same levels of motivation as we did during that ooh-ah moment like I had seeing President Obama when I was a little boy.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the Democratic Party. Do you feel like there is space carved out for Latino communities in the Democratic Party? Like, do you feel like, sometimes I feel like there is no Black agenda for the Democratic Party. Like, they're not saying this group of people are living in a different, American experience than other people. So we need to target some of these specific issues. Do you feel like there is space carved out for Latino voters, the Latino experience, like issues that are unique to your community in the Democratic Party?
I think that there are many layers to that that have to be addressed. I will say progress has been made and progress looks different for different communities. And, you know, from being someone that's been engaged in this for quite some time now, I can see that sometimes progress can be very difficult to attain because a lot of it is you may have people that are interested, that want to get involved, but before you can get them to that point of being politically or civically engaged, you have to address other barriers that they experience in their life, mm-hmm. right? So for a lot of like the young people that I've gotten involved in different campaigns or learning the process, a lot of it was, okay, do you have a way to get there? Do you have food? Are you getting paid? You know, seeing if we can assess things like paid opportunities. is the literature speaking to your community, right? Mm-hmm. Are these things not only translated, but are they culturally relevant? Do they take into consideration social dynamics and power structures that exist within your community? And so I think when I, you know, do my own work of building the base and building up our people to be engaged, I have to be really intentional. And sometimes I think what our community struggles with is we don't always have enough people to carry forth this work.
Yeah, and I think part of it too is just an understanding that sometimes when there's not a place made for you, you make one. And like when my grandma marched with Martin Luther King, I don't know if anyone was courting her to be a Democratic Party member, right? But I think it's really important for us to understand we were one of the reasons JFK got elected. We were the part of the reason why Clinton was elected. And when you look at the Democratic Party nationally in other states where there is higher Latino population that's concentrated, many people in the Democratic Party are Latino. Mm-hmm. So for that reason, I think of New Mexico, Joe. So for that reason, the state culture represents a different energy around party membership, right? So, you know, thinking about party membership or thinking about our Latino identity in context to New York and the incredible diverse culture we have here, you know, I think it's easy for many of us to feel like our voices are being lost in the shuffle because there are so many. Mm-hmm. But in other states where I've visited and there are others in the Latino Party, in the Democratic Party and the Latino community who have reached levels of leadership, mm-hmm. which I think are really incredible.
Yeah. I remember in 2020, all summer, just trying to get people registered to vote, right?
Yeah.
And I remember standing under a tent on the corner of Jefferson and Utica, mm-hmm. grilling hot dogs to get people free food to,
yes.
be able to come over to us.
Let's
That's
go.
Right.
And saying, like, you know, just so you know, in New York now, even if you have a felony conviction on your record, you can register to vote.
Incredible. Right.
And a lot of people didn't know that. A lot of people who were like, oh, I'm a Democrat, I didn't know I could vote. So do you think it should be the responsibility, or at least in part the responsibility, for the Democratic Party on a national level, on local levels, to help remove some of the barriers? Because we know these barriers exist. Like, you know, we grew up in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. Like, we face one barrier after another. So if I'm a Democratic candidate and I'm trying to get people to vote for me, should I also say, okay, I understand the barriers that people who I want to vote for me are facing. So instead of just trying to get their vote, I'm going to urge the party who's backing me potentially to help remove some of these barriers, whether it's information, whether it's just making sure people understand the voting process, understand why they should vote in the first place. Mm-hmm. Should the Democratic Party take some responsibility?
Do you want to answer first?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a whole rounded approach that can be taken from that, from a party perspective, and then also from an individual campaign perspective, right? Because the respective candidates who are running to represent their communities also have the deepest understanding of what it is that their voters are looking for or want to say, right? So, like, for me, whenever I go around and I'm getting a signature, I'm doing canvassing or whatever the case may be, I'm also, you know, engaging people in the process. I'm leaving flyers. I'm giving them information or a QR code for them to scan of different resources that are available to them that are also translated in multiple languages. And then also building genuine connection outside. I don't just come around to a community when I need a signature. That's just not my thing. I mean, I come around and I knock on someone's door just because there's a block party happening down the street. And so I think being intentional about continuous engagement is incredibly important. And then also building relationships with people, right? Being open, accessible, transparent, that's really huge. A lot of times, you know, when I go and talk to people, if I'm getting a signature or I'm doing canvassing or whatever the case may be, I'm going to ask, what matters to you? What is it that you want to see? What's working? What's not working? Take a note of that. Take their number and follow through. And sometimes if you don't have an answer, at least right now, a commitment to finding one, right? Or a commitment to working together to make things better. But I think something that's going to be instrumental is going to be, as I mentioned, that general civic engagement. But neighborhood ownership is going to be really huge, right? As people decide and come together as to what their neighborhoods are going to look like, whether that be through revitalizing small business corridors to help employ more people in the area and to keep wealth in a community, whether it come through home ownership, all of these things add up and increase someone's ability to not only be civically engaged, but to continuously be able to vote and address the real issues that their communities are facing. So I think there's many approaches that could be taken in collaboration with different systems working together.
I have I love this answer, which is really, really good. And then I have just that something to add to. And I know that I'm annoying because every time someone asks me a question, I answer about history. But succinctly, I don't know that they really know how to. Mm-hmm. I think, as Alex said, we know how to move our own community. And when I was doing my research about civil rights, Jill, I wanted to know who fed people. right? Mm-hmm. Who was feeding people when they were coming into town? Who was moving people when we needed to move thousands of people? And that were those were mechanisms within our community. And I found stories of women who hosted like amazing, like thousand portion meals in their homes, right? But are those stories told, and do we feel ownership over those stories that we are the reason that this democracy stands and we know how to organize ourselves? Mm-hmm. So we need their help, but Joe, I don't know how much if we have the right resources. And then also, shout out to them, though. It's an amazing thing to be able to pick, right? Because I feel like in some places there's not as much choice. But the latter, I would say, where I do really agree is that I feel, and this may is also very like dorky, but like I feel that civic engagement or teaching political efficacy is something we should do in our schools. Mm-hmm. And that should be part of the message that our students receive. You are powerful, not only in this nation, but as a part of this school system. Mm-hmm. And these are the ways that your voices can be heard. And I feel like over time, when we create systems to support those young leaders, they advance and become those adults who are like, no, this, that. And to Alex's point, when we were talking about campaigns, I was like, we need a carcade. Mm-hmm. Like, we need people to pick people up. Mm-hmm. Because I know people in my family need to be picked up for the polls. So
transportation's huge.
You know, I think just balancing it with tapping into that knowledge that is really in our communities, but maybe, as to your prior point, not often told, and then also creating a generation that feels capable.
Yeah. And speaking of our future generations, do you think they're being energized enough? And I don't mean, you know, bringing Megan Thee Stallion out to campaign stop and performing a song. I mean, do they have enough? Are they being given a reason to hope, a reason to say that even though right now we're entering one of those periods of turmoil, I'm going to still have faith that in 4 years, 6 years, 8 years, 10 years from now, things won't look and feel like this. Mm. Are they being given a reason to even think that going out to the polls and voting is worth it?
I think that a lot of people in our community are just trying to survive today and are just trying to survive each and every day. And so I don't think that a lot of them, you know, have the life circumstances to be able to think that far out. But when you talk to them and build those relationships, they are very passionate about issues. And so, especially when I'm talking to Hispanic youth and youth of color in general, having a more issue-based approach and conversation as opposed to talking about the politics of it all and the system in general tends to be more effective. And, you know, when you see that passion, then it's how do we create that access for them to actually be involved, right? That can be through things like offering, paid campaign opportunities. A lot of our youth want to work in these things. A lot of our youth want to learn what the process looks like. But again, many of our youth are going to high school or going to college and then going straight to a job right afterwards. Mm-hmm. Sometimes maybe at hours that don't align with their school schedule or, they may have a gap in their schedule and they only have so much time to rest. Or they're quite literally going from school, getting on a bus and then going straight to an overnight job. I've seen that before. So the conversation needs to start as to what is it that you care about and understanding them as who they are as individuals. And then from there, once you have that and you understand what it is that they're interested in, what they care about, create that access.
So I would say, as a mom to my 7-year-old Latino son, I explained to him that there are people with the very same name as him standing in a field, right? Who may be 12 years old. And they share common identities. So, you know, everybody's America, in my view, Jill, is important. But I think when we talk about the Latino community, there are certain privileges that my son has and lives that I want him to be very aware are not the same for everyone in Generation Alpha that was born in between 2000 and 2024. And my further point, you are one of the reasons they are energized. Literally, as you asked that question, I was like, it's so crazy for her to ask this question because I've seen you energize people in our city. But their relationship with Americanism and then also with technology. Mm-hmm. How is the technology that we're introducing to them impacting their self-esteem? How is it impacting their understanding of what their version of America is? And also, how will it better prepare them for the workforce? So I love that question. And I want to say succinctly, you are one of the reasons they are inspired. And that's an honest answer.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
I do think it's important that we put a lot of energy behind not just energizing youth to want to go vote, but making sure that they understand that it's worth it. Mm-hmm. You know, even when you talk about, I have so many younger cousins, kids that I work with, this most recent election, they're like, well, we don't ultimately decide who wins anyway. So why even bother? So while I feel like, obviously, as citizens, we take accountability and responsibility for that, just like in a succinct yes or no, do you think that the Democratic Party, who want these votes, who need people to come out and vote, can do more?
Always, yes. Always, we can always improve. Yeah. I think we always, as Americans, should have that perspective.
Yeah.
A growth mindset's important.
Yeah.
So I agree.
And more food, always.
Always.
Jill, I'm looking you deep in your face.
All right. Well, we will be right back. This is What's Next on WBFO, and we're going to jump to a quick break.
Our mission at Buffalo Toronto Public Media is to serve our local community. And on WBFO, we do that by keeping you informed. We bring you important perspectives from your neighbors on what's next.
It's cultural heritage tourism. People go and they travel different places to learn about history and lived experiences that only took place in that area. Oftentimes, you may have people in certain positions that don't understand the value of cultural heritage tourism.
And we investigate issues in our community, such as racial disparities and traffic stops.
The data breakdown by council district shows that Black people are stopped disproportionately to their population in all 9 districts. Lovejoy District leads the pack in terms of those disproportionate stops. Just 37% of the district's population is Black, yet Black motorists account for almost 70% of stop receipts issued there.
This is Public Media.
From the fringes of the mainstream to the local music you love, listen to WBFO The Bridge Monday through Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight on WBFO 88.7 or your smart speaker.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
We are back. This is What's Next on WBFO. I am your host, Jillian Hainsworth. I'm joined by Alex Burgos and Talia Rodriguez. We're having a really good conversation around the Hispanic vote. So let's talk about something a little bit more recent. Recently, November 5th, my poor birthday, we had an election. And Donald Trump became the nominee for the next president. He now is the president again. Mm-hmm. When you look at the voter trends, like, it kind of, they try to break it down by demographics. So, like, Black women voted for such and such, white women voted for such and such. I feel like a lot of people were shocked at the amount of Latino voters in general who voted for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Why do you think he got their vote? Like, what was it that they were able to connect to say, this is in my best interest?
Do you want to go first? Or?
I think, you know, as I mentioned earlier, from the data captured from Univision, up to 60% of them were not necessarily committed to any party, right? Mm-hmm. And so they became this segment of voters that either candidate or either party, you know, could have essentially scooped up should their platform have resonated with those voters. But, you know, as Talia had mentioned, the biggest issue for them was the economy. I also think, too, if you're looking at the timeline of the election, our vice president did not have enough time to properly, you know, lay out a campaign for each individual community. As Trump did, you know, because Trump was doing interviews on Univision before she became the nominee, correct? And so it put her to a disadvantage because she was now not only having a campaign full steam ahead, but she wouldn't have been able to lay out what I'm sure would have probably been her original vision and plan. And we saw in response to, you know, the comments that were made about Puerto Rico at one of Trump's rallies in Madison Square Garden, our vice president in that moment very diligently expressed her commitment to our community and uplifting our community and crafting a vision for our community and with our community in solidarity with our community, given the timeline. So I really think a lot of it was just the timing of it all and the way that everything went down.
Yeah, I think when I answer questions about the Latino community in general, I try to think about where we get our data from, Jill. And like, we have exit polling, right? And exit polling isn't in every state, but from the exit polls we saw closest to New York, which were Pennsylvania, where we've had a high concentration of Latinos moving, specifically Puerto Ricans, to Allentown and to other areas where they've had a bigger voice in local parties. When they were interviewed, again, they touching back on economy, right? But I think the thing that needs to be stated too is when you look at the breakdown of who voted or who was swayed read the most at the presidential level, it was males, right? Mm-hmm. And males of a certain age. So I think understanding too the fragility of our vice president's identity as a candidate. So she's a female and she's trying to garner support in regions of the country where traditionally people from her state are not welcome, right? So when you go to the South and when you go to Texas and you try to present yourself as a national candidate, right? That's a challenging thing for people to do, period, historically, no matter what their identity was. And I think Trump has done, Trump and the Republican Party have done very well into kind of making people forget he's a New Yorker and taking parts of his image and really trying to bring it down to the level of like the working man level and kind of almost reshape this narrative around who he is and why he should be chosen and seeing him more as a part of their community than they did our vice president.
Yeah.
And I also think, too, as Talia mentioned, you know, from an identity fragility standpoint, as people of color, as professionals of color in spaces, we're often told that we have to be excellent mm-hmm. and better than the absolute rest and mm-hmm. that we have to have a certain kind of guard and maintain a certain veil of professionalism that hides our identity mm-hmm. In order to be palatable to succeed, right?
Like proximity to whiteness.
Yeah, and so oftentimes that same thing that we're told we need to do to succeed mm-hmm. is the very thing that harms us in garnering power in national elections, because then a lot of people at the ground are going to view us as this person that's way up there and who can't come back down to earth. But the moment we do come back down to earth, then other narratives are placed
down
on us, not the narrative of we're resonating with the working class or, you know, that we're just like that. Then our qualifications come into question, mm-hmm. right? And so if you look historically and socially, people of color, professionals of color are, you know, told you have to do one thing and then it kind of leads into another, while also be told you can't be this and you can't be that. And so politically, we're placed in these rooms where we can never please anyone, it almost feels like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that has disproportionately impacted not only Latinos who want to ascend to those positions, but for people who want to, you know, garner our vote.
Yeah. I was just thinking about Trump and context to people who are Latinos who are veterans, right? Mm-hmm. When they looked at our vice president versus Trump, she had no military experience, right? There was no one in her close family, I think, unless I'm wrong, which I would open correction from both of you, that had served in the military, that was part of her narrative. Trump had gone to military school. There's pictures of him in uniforms, right? If I'm trying to find likeness in someone, when I'm talking about fragility, I mean, you're now presenting yourself as a candidate for president who's also gonna be the head of the armed forces. Mm-hmm. And I had conversations with people in my family about why I thought she was capable, right? And why I was willing to vote for her and why I think women are capable of commanding armed forces because of my longitudinal understanding of history, again, Jill. But I think for me, when I think about when I'm trying to present myself as a candidate to people of that same demographic, what are the ways they see differences between me and them? And that's the same way that they saw the difference between themselves and our vice president. Yeah. And I also want to make clear, very clear, that I'm a biracial person. I am, in fact, white, and that I'm Puerto Rican, Irish, and Sicilian. So it's really important for me in these spaces to show up and to, you know, be proud of all of my heritages. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, my understanding of my community is impacted by being biracial.
Yeah. And I mean, misogyny definitely plays a role in every community.
How many minutes do we have, Jill?
It's say, can a woman be in charge? And that's going to be a conversation. I feel like that's another whole nother episode. I think one of the interesting things, when I think about this most recent election, I think about Vice President Harris and the time, lack thereof, that she had to really establish herself as an independent candidate, or a Democratic candidate independent of
Joe
Biden. Obviously, there were a lot of wrinkles and a lot of things that could have been done a lot better when it came to establishing her as the candidate. And we can talk about what we think Joe Biden could have done better. We could talk about what we think the Democratic Party could have done better. We could talk about a lot of different things. When it comes to Trump, however, the very unique thing about this election is we already experienced a Trump presidency. Like, right. We had historical experience. So it wasn't just, you know, what they're telling me they can do or how they're presenting themselves in their campaign. It's how was my life when he was the president? What fears did I have when he was the president? What did he say? What did he do? What did he show me? Who did he show me he was during his time as president? I think about the hurricane in Puerto Rico and mm-hmm. Trump going and throwing paper towels around, and that's it. I think about the amount of funds that we give to Black and brown countries when they deal with natural disasters, things like that, versus the amount of funding we give to European countries who deal with wars that have nothing to do with us. So I guess my question is, did Trump's last term as president play a role in the Latino voters' projection of what this presidency would look like? Because we're talking a lot about the information that Kamala was able to provide mm-hmm. and or lack thereof, but we actually experienced a Trump presidency. Yeah. So was that considered, do you think, by a lot of people? Or was it just like, we're washing our hands of the old and now we're going to just look at him as a new candidate?
I think that's a really good question, Joe. Wasn't that enough to move people to the polls? I think that, I mean, succinctly, when I was within myself as a citizen trying to find these answers, a lot of the data I found mm-hmm. wasn't from New York State.
Yeah.
So I tried to piece together an answer for myself nationally, like, where are my people and why do they feel different ways, or like, what's in their spirit? Mm-hmm. Because I feel that there are certain things that are in the undercurrent of the way that we present power in some of these contexts that are dangerous, right? And scary for me as a mother, right? As a son of a Latino child whose name is Latino, right? Whose identity, you know, means different things in different times depending on who's leading his country. So, you know, more so than as a political scientist, as a mother, I'm trying to ask myself, how do I prepare my child for the next 4 years? And what are the messages I'm giving him about democracy? And one of them that I just settle on is we have to be persistent. Mm. We just have to be incessant, that we have equality in the paces that we fight for it. And whether that's on the media or in literature or on YouTube or wherever we find community, we just have to be incessant with putting those messages of love and inclusion out alongside whatever else is coming.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the messaging is going to be important. And as I mentioned, it has to be consistent and continue to resonate and evolve with our community. And so what you're seeing in our community, the issues are shifting. Our community is becoming more diverse as you see people from all over the world moving to the United States. So the perspectives are becoming more diverse. I also think the outlets, as Talia had mentioned, that our communities are consuming information by is shifting rapidly. Mm-hmm. But also protecting the integrity of those platforms is going to be incredibly important. Many Latinos, their prime source of information is going to be social media. It mm-hmm. is going to be through platforms that are owned by Meta and Facebook, in particular, Facebook groups, community pages, and so forth. Protecting the integrity of those, strengthening our neighborhood publications, that's going to be integral. But national outlets like Univision and Telemundo are going to play a large role in creating not only the national dialogue, but opening up the spaces for those platforms to be seen and heard. And so, you know, I'm hoping that in combination with all of those, as well as comprehensive campaign strategies at the national level, that, you know, eventually invest more advertisement dollars and targeted campaign resources into our community, that we will see better outcomes, or at least more civic engagement and awareness.
Because I want to say there are certain communities where more communities of color voted. Mm-hmm. Right. But did they vote the way that we thought they were going to vote? Or Jill, one of the other questions I asked in my column was who wasn't registered? And if they did show up that day, how may have that reshaped the understanding that both of our communities have? Because I know there were African-Americans that voted for Trump. Right. Mm-hmm. Especially older men. I think some of the data showed it's like, well, who wasn't registered? And, you know, what is other work that we do that you, I think you acknowledge the work of having those who are part of the reentry population fully re-enfranchised in democracy mm-hmm. that we can continue to work on to continue to pluralize who can vote and why should they vote.
What do you think are some of the current concerns now that we have Trump in office specifically for some people in the Latino community? Like, what are some of the anxieties now? Like, I could talk about a ton of anxieties of like the Black American community, but like, for example, if you're Black American and your family is all Black and we are descendants of slaves, right? My family came into America during the slave trade through South Carolina. So like, I understand that, but my family, they're Americans. So like immigration, for example, like when my family vote, we don't have to think this candidate might send my like undocumented family members away or back home. I do have that concern for some of my other Black, you know, friends and people that are part of my community. I've had friends and community members deported back to Congo, to, you know, different African countries. Is that a concern right now, now that we see what some of Trump's actions have been since he's...
I mean, it's a concern and it's a reality at this mm-hmm. point. I mean, we've seen that, you know, ICE has gone very aggressively in invading communities mm-hmm. and, you know, conducting mass deportations. And that's going to be seen, unfortunately, here in Buffalo. Yep. Some of the most vulnerable zip codes are going to be 14201 and 14213.
Yep.
You know, on our West Side community, where a lot of our Hispanic, actually where the highest concentration of the Hispanic community is, and it's growing increasingly diverse. So it's not only a platform, it's something we are witnessing in real time.
Okay, hold that thought. We are going to jump to a quick break. This is WBFO, What's Next? We will be right back.
Did you know that WNED PBS is always working on great new local shows for you to watch? Documentaries like Klein Hand's Gift to Buffalo, which tells the story of Buffalo's Music Hall.
The hall is very intimate, and that intimacy makes everyone who comes in here feel a part of our family.
Fun and educational series like Compact Science.
Believe it or not, peppers are technically fruits.
And Shakespeare's greatest hits featuring some of his best-known soliloquies and monologues.
We are such stuff as dreams are made of.
You can watch them all on our website at wned.org/local shows. While you're there, check out the show pages and mini websites for additional content such as bonus features, photo galleries, and lesson plans. Find it all at wned.org/local shows.
Attention parents and teachers. Find free learning resources, including lesson plans and videos for all ages at pbslearningmedia.org.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email what's next at WBFO.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
This is What's Next on WBFO. I'm your host, Jillian Hainsworth. I'm joined by Alex Burgos and Talia Rodriguez. So before the break, we started to talk a little bit about ICE and the deportations that we've been seeing throughout the country and that we will continue to see, unfortunately. One of the things that happened most recently was ICE tried to enter the school in Chicago, and the school refused to let them in, which is like... period. Like, don't let them in. And I started watching like TikToks, and I was seeing people giving others advice. Like, if ICE knocks on your door, you don't have to open the door unless there's like an active warrant or a judge order. Do you see information like that being pushed out in the Latino community to kind of offer some like protection and things like that? And what other information or advice would you be able to give?
I know I've seen a couple of info sessions and Know Your Rights sessions, you know, already start up. Mm-hmm. We actually went to one very recently, you know, on the West Side. And so the information is out there. But a lot of people fear entering into those spaces because they may be impacted people, or they may not, you know, depending on the setting. Our community experiences a lot of fears of places that look too institutional.
Yeah.
And so sometimes it may have to really be, to get this information out there properly, it may have to be very grassroots. It may have to be canvas to canvas, door to door. Mm-hmm. You're going to lose some people knocking on those doors, because if you're going on their door and you're talking about something that's already very sensitive and they are an impacted person,
it's scary.
Even if you're going there as an advocate, they're not going to trust it.
Yeah.
They're not going to trust it. And so... multiple mechanisms. There's going to be a component of news and media. There's going to be a component of localized news and media, social media. I think flyering and canvassing is going to be really important.
Mm-hmm.
The Know Your Rights are very valuable, but there are also some downsides that we lose some people in that.
Yeah.
And I think when we talk about our relationship with law enforcement, right? My father was a law enforcement agency, my father was a law enforcement person. Several people in my family are. I don't think any of us are saying that we don't support people who work for the peace of our nation. I think part of the conversation is understanding how public servants can be weaponized to create environments of fear, right? Within children and within holy spaces, and really confronting that as citizens. And understanding for me, so I went to law school, Jill, but I didn't pass the bar. And that's something that I'm processing. How do I contribute to my Latina sisters who are immigration attorneys, who are fighting these wars within their community nationally to get information out?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think one of the things that I can do is continue to cheer them on, but say that there are attorneys and lawyers and policymakers that have, you know, set up phone lines and are organizing things locally. But I think to Alex's point, you know, it's going to continue to be a push that we maintain the civility that we've always had around these, especially for me as a person of faith, holy spaces, right?
Yeah.
No matter who's inside.
Right.
Especially if the pastor's talking.
Especially
si el pastor está hablando. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Because
it's like, that's a sensitive time,
mm-hmm.
especially in the smaller churches.
Yeah. Well, you're actually entering the... world of politics and advocacy.
And what a great time, right, Jill? Definitely well thought out on my part to be
you
here.
You know, but a necessary time.
Yes,
a rough
absolutely.
Time, but a necessary. Sometimes the hardest times are the most necessary.
Okay, amen.
So you're throwing your hat in the ring for Buffalo Public School Board.
Yeah.
As someone who's advocating not just for, you know, not just for the Latino community, but for mothers, for kids, like as somebody who's truly a community advocate, like what are some of the messages that you want to send through your campaign and potentially your role as a member of the school board to help protect our youth and to give them a future where democracy can work for them?
Yeah, absolutely. So one, I think good citizenship starts in school. You know, they have a voice in their school system, in the broader community. I mean, I know there's been some amazing work nationally around food justice and mm-hmm. having teens be involved in teen-driven and student-driven projects. I think student voice is essential to democracy, and that in our schools, teaching and is putting in that concentrated adult effort into building self-esteem will equal long-term political efficacy, will equal their ability to understand they can impact their democracy. I also want to tell other people of many diverse communities and working class people, politics is for you. Democracy is for you. You can do it. Mm-hmm. You can be a candidate. Maybe my wash isn't done as fast as possible. And I mean, certain people literally, when I say that, they like look at me like, I can't believe you're saying that. But, you know, women ask me or parents ask me, how do you balance it all? I just want to be a good example that you have to try. And that also democracy is for the average Buffalonian, right? And we have a beautiful history of it, and it needs to be upholded by you and by others in the arts. And it's a robust thing. It's not just politics. It's the arts. It's, you know, journalism. It's so many things. But just that I feel in good support by having a city that turns out, you know.
Where can we find information about your campaign?
Well, you have a Facebook and Instagram. They're all Talia for BPS, so they're synonymous. And then there's also your email, mm-hmm. TaliaForBPS@gmail.com. Yeah. You know, you have a number of upcoming events, you know, and obviously, you know, you're accessible. You're everywhere in the community. People can stop you. Listen, when we go on Niagara Street, people stop traffic to say hi to us.
A lot of times they're relatives, but I think we do have a really great hope for what this city can message to the rest of the state in terms of how do you maintain hope and active democracy in conversation. And the space that you're building here is beautiful, Joe. I'm really excited that you invited us.
And I mean, we're an open book. We're both everywhere in the community. It's like I've said, I mean, I try to make myself available, you know, as much as I can. I have my personal social media out there. People message me about things all the time. I'm always connecting people.
They could also find me on your followers list.
Yes.
That is a fact. I'm pretty sure. Fact check on Instagram.
So. Both of us. Yeah. So, I mean, this is an incredibly important seat because it not only contributes to the schools. If you think about the roles that schools play in neighborhood stabilization and development for our city mm-hmm. by creating, you know, and stabilizing our school ecosystem, you create neighborhoods that people want to consider living in. There are a lot of people that love the city of Buffalo, that love it with all their hearts, but unfortunately leave mm-hmm. because there's issues in the schools.
Yeah.
And so we need people like Talia who have that well-rounded approach and that experience and that drive to succeed and that creative thinking to be able to address those issues in collaboration, you know, with the many relationships that you've built with and all levels of government. And so I think, you know, when you threw your hat in the ring, it was like, she's the girl for the job.
Yeah. It's a great time to be a candidate in the city of Buffalo right now, Joe. It really
okay.
is.
Okay. So last question. If you could send a message or a call to action to Latino voters here in Buffalo or in New York State or in the country, what would you say?
Pa'lante. It's the same message we've had the entire time. Pa'lante, which just basically means keep up the fight.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, to expand on that, as our community has grown, we're starting to make up significant portions of not only municipalities, but every institution in our school community as well. And at this point, it's only equitable when these large decisions are made and significant amounts of money are being allocated throughout the community that we have our representation at the table.
Yeah, it's time. Women were given the right in 1880 to vote for a school district. In 145 years, there's never been a Latina serve on the Buffalo Public School Board. I aspire to be the first one. I'm not the first one to run, but with the confidence of our neighbors who are listening and ultimately, hopefully, their votes, mm-hmm. I will be. And, you know, we'll as a community have a greater ability, in my view, to impact the future.
Beautiful. And besides what's next on WBFO, WBFO, NPR stations, where would you suggest Latino communities get their information?
Yeah. So the Latino papers, there's Panorama Hispano, there's the Buffalo Latino Village, there's La Última Hora, there's CNY Latino. And to continue to follow you, because obviously you're creating spaces for allyship.
Oh, thank you. That's important. Thank you.
Well,
thank you both so much for being here today. I hope that the work that you're doing is notice it thrives, that it creates the change that we need to happen in our city, and then that change will then trickle through our state and our country. Keeping people informed is crucial. So I know that's what you do, that's what I do, that's what we all need to be doing. If you're listening, that's what you need to be doing. So thank you for joining us. We are here with Alex Burgos, who is a 2024 delegate for the DNC, the only Hispanic 2024 delegate. Talia Rodriguez, who is a mother, a community advocate, and a candidate for Buffalo Public School Board of Education for West District. This is Jillian Hainsworth, and this is WBFO What's Next.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.